This podcast is sponsored by El Spilio, maker of some of the best caving lights on the planet. And thank you if you reached out to me over the last month to show interest in borrowing my El Spilio Lunatic. I put it out there that I want this thing to see more action than I can show it, and you showed up. But I'm going to give it one more month. So if you're interested in borrowing that thing and taking it to the places it deserves to go, send me an email, alpineproductions@gmail.com, alpineproductions@gmail.com, and let me know what you do with it. I'll mail it straight to you. I'll take care of the shipping, no problem. And you can try out one of the best caving lights on the planet, the El Spilio Lunatic. Or if you want to get one yourself, you can go to elspilio.com and save $20 when you buy a Lunatic or any light that they sell there by using the promo code podcast at checkout, elspilio.com. I'll link you to elspilio.com in the description of this podcast, the show notes there. And the great thing about elspilio.com is if you've already got one and you're having some trouble with any of the parts, need anything replaced, he can help you out. If you're in a position to go with the best, go to elspilio.com and get it there. Welcome to the Caving Podcast. I'm your host, Matt Pelser, of the Central Indiana Grotto. What is a grotto? It's like a local chapter of the National Speleological Society. If you're just joining this podcast, welcome. I'm glad you're here. If you have looked around and you've found that cavers can really be kind of secretive, can't they? Well, there are reasons for that. It can be a little off-putting. We're trying our best to explain why, and there are good reasons oftentimes for why we would want to keep things under wraps, so to speak. We don't want trespassing in sensitive caves. We also don't want people to get hurt, because caving can be dangerous if you don't know what you're doing. And numerous rescues have taken place of people going in without sufficient light, without sufficient protection, without any number of things. So go with somebody who knows what they're doing. Find your local grotto. They've always got people who are willing to take beginners under whatever circumstances. And you can find your local grotto through a link in the show notes. Check it out there now. The guest this month is Crash Kennedy. And I remember I first heard about Crash from another guest of this podcast, Dean Wiseman. He's talked a lot about him and a lot of the work that he's done. And you know, he's been caving with him before and always thought, I got to have this guy on. Well, thankfully, made it happen. More on Crash in just a little bit. Indiana Cave Capers is this coming weekend. If you're listening to this the day that this comes out, Indiana Cave Capers is the first full weekend in August. I'm going to be emceeing the banquet. I'm hoping to work registration a little bit. I can't wait to meet Hazel Barton in person. She's going to be doing the main presentation that Saturday night. And if you are going to be in the area or willing to make a road trip to the Crawford County Fairgrounds in Indiana, you know we got room for you. So come to Indiana Cave Capers the first full weekend in August. That'd be the 6th, 7th, and 8th. And there's going to be plenty of trips going out. And I'm going to be doing impromptu caving podcast interviews. A few years ago, I think it was 2017, when I was chair of the grotto, I set up shop there at registration and got to do a bunch of interviews. I'm going to be bringing my microphones with me and, you know, just asking a few questions, do a few little short one-off interviews, and I'm hoping to turn that into an episode coming up. So we'll see you at Indiana Cave Capers August 6th, 7th, and 8th at the Crawford County Fairgrounds in southern Indiana. A lot of great caves around there and hope you can see some of them. All right, Crash Kennedy, he is the chair of the National Cave and Karst Management Symposium, which we talk a lot about. You can find more on that with a link in the show notes. He is also chairing the 2025 convention. I know it's a little early to be talking about that, but we talk a little bit about it. He also has gated a number of caves professionally throughout the country, and we talk about best practices there. He's worked with Bat Conservation International, and we just talk about all of it, including how he got his nickname, Crash. You're about to hear that in just a second. So, Jim, Crash, Kennedy, this month's guest on the Caving Podcast. Anyone who knows you knows where the nickname came from, but could you share that for people who might not be familiar?
Oh, sure. Back in the day, I used to work for the Pennsylvania Game Commission doing bat work with them. We were doing a survey in a place called Canoe Creek Mine, which intersected a whole lot of natural caves. They didn't have entrances previously. This was the only place known at the time in the state of Pennsylvania that had Indiana bats, so it was very important. And we were down a 30-foot pit off of one of the mine passages, And I was moving to a cluster of Indiana bats to count them, and a breakdown floor collapsed and took me with it. And
oh my gosh.
I rolled and tumbled and went off a ledge and apparently fell right on my butt and broke both sides of my pelvis. And it was a really big rescue. I mean, it was like a 7-hour rescue, and I spent the next 14 days in a hospital flat on my back. And that's pretty much where the name came from.
Any residual issues with that? Obviously, hasn't kept you from caving.
No, it hasn't. Sometimes recovery from caving trips takes a little longer, but it doesn't stop me.
So you got started where a lot of people get started, in Boy Scouts. When would you say the bug caught you?
Oh, it was pretty much immediately. This was back in like 1973, and my father was a scoutmaster. In real life, he was a school teacher, a high school teacher. One of his students was a cave guide at one of the local show caves. And so he asked me, he said, hey, you know any, you know, wild caves that like to take the boys caving sometime on a, you know, give them that experience? And he said, sure, we'll go here. And that was it. It was great. I mean, I did that and went back several other times with family. And in high school, you know, had some friends that we went. And I think to this day, my mom doesn't know this, but, you know, we used to skip school in the afternoons with one of my buddies that had a car and go up to this local show cave, Laurel Caverns. You could buy two different tickets. You could buy one ticket for the tour with the lighted parts and the walkways and all that stuff, or another ticket for what they called the exploratory, which was everything else in the cave. And it's a fairly long cave. There's, you know, like almost 4 miles of passage there. So it was really awesome. And we would go up there, and, you know, we were still speedlunkers at the time. We had helmets, and we had extra lights and all that, but, you know, we still didn't know much of what we were doing. But we would do this, and, you know, I was in the academic program, so the teacher would give us hall passes to go to the library, and it was pretty easy to do this. We were, you know, always ahead of everybody else in the class. So that was fun. And then when I got to college, I went to Penn State and learned about the Nittany Grotto. And man, that was it. That was all it took. You know, started getting vertical training and learning about cave survey and everything else. It was never looked back.
And then how long until you got into like real exploration caving? Because like there are some people like me who never really got there. Life just didn't allow it. And other people for whom it's the only thing.
Well, in the Nittany Grotto, it was a very, very active grotto. I mean, people were digging, people were surveying, people were doing all kinds of things. And I immediately fell into that. We would be out ridge walking, and, you know, we'd go to a couple of caves. And I've always been a map geek also since I was a kid. I love maps. And we'd get to a cave, and it's like, you know, I want to see the map of this cave. They say, oh, it hasn't been surveyed yet. And I said, well, I guess I'll learn survey. And so I did, and we'd go and survey. My first maps were, you know, fairly simple, fairly crude. They weren't very sophisticated. But eventually we moved on to another project. There was a cave called Ruth Cave, which was found in a road cut. It was a fun cave, but it was only about 500 feet long. But it was enticing because it had airflow. And another friend of mine and I, we used to go out in the evenings after classes because it was close. We could do, you know, weeknight caving. And we would dig and we'd move breakdown. We'd push and push and push, trying to follow this airflow. And we never got very far. But there was another lead in a cave that was this little bedrock hole you could toss pebbles through, and, you know, you'd hear it, but air was just howling out of this hole. And so with a couple other friends, we enlarged that hole, you know, by probably now illegal means, but we enlarged the hole, crawled through, and found almost a mile of cave. And that Wow. became my project for a while. It was heavily decorated. I've made over 75 trips to that cave. I've counted them. And that was my first big survey project. And I was on all the survey trips into the cave, and I drafted up the map and everything. And it was just a lot of fun. That was a great, great cave and great project.
So a lot of trips into that cave. Is that a fairly popular cave now among cavers, or what's the status?
Well, it was. It's been gated to protect it. The landowner requested gating. And it's turned into an important bat cave as well. So it's closed in the winter months, of course. But cavers can go there in the summer. It's not a problem. All you just have to do is get a hold with the, I guess it's a steward person that's holding the keys for the landowner. And, you know, they'll let you in, no problem.
Whenever I talk to somebody, and I don't think I've done this on the podcast yet, but whenever I talk to somebody in person who makes maps, what do you think makes a good map?
Well, the map really needs to convey what the cave is like. I mean, if you just look at it and you see a couple of lines and a few words on it, you don't really get an idea of whether it's, you know, tight or steep or walking passage or whatever. I mean, you need to have that cave shown in three dimensions. So you have to have a good plan map, you know, the top view, a good profile map, which is the side view, and then numerous cross sections to kind of show what the shape of the passage is as you're going through. And of course, you know, a lot of text, a lot of explanation helps as well. I see a lot of people that make maps of caves and they say, well, it's fairly flat. But, you know, how do you know that? Just looking at a plan view, you've got to have a profile. Even if it's a flat cave and it's all crawling, still put a profile on there. And then, you know, it's immediately apparent, you know, what you're in for when you go to that cave.
But what if you're in an area like, I mean, I'm thinking of Indiana, where the limestone is plentiful, but not all that deep. And when it comes to like a 3D profile, I mean, I'm not talking about like Tag or Mexico or anything like that, where it's like, you know, you're dealing in some areas where the limestone's like a mile thick, but in an area where there's not going to be a whole lot of this level versus this level. I mean, sure, in some maps, there's a way to tell which is the upper level and which is the lower level, but do you think it's still important in that way, or do other things become important?
No, I think it's still important. I think every cave deserves a profile as well as a plan view. You can also depict depth in various other ways. You can put what we call spot elevations. That's those little numbers with the line under it or a line over it that tells you the depth or the height above or below your datum, your zero datum, which is usually the entrance. So having those spot depths are good as well. But the profile, I mean, it's visual. I'm a visual thinker, and I look at these things, and I can say, oh, yeah, I know right what the cave's doing now, even if it is flat.
Well, and you ran the salon at conventions. I don't know, have you, as part of that, judged maps, or did you just kind of coordinate the whole deal?
I've judged maps long before I became the salon coordinator, taking over for George Dasher, who did it for, geez, I don't know, decades maybe. I still do that because I like maps, and we've always thought of the cartographic salon as an educational thing. Yeah, it's a competition, but it's a friendly competition. One of the main things we like to do is give feedback to cartographers. We always have a debrief on Friday after the awards are given out. People can come and say, well, you know, why did this map get more points than this map, or why did this map get only a green ribbon? Getting that feedback from your peers is really, really important. It lets you know what they really liked, first of all, you know, what kind of innovations you've done or what you may have done better. I've seen so many maps and salons get dinged for really stupid stuff, like, you know, misspellings. Get your map proofread. I've always tell cartographers, if you're submitting a map for a salon, you know, that's a competition. You know, it's not cutthroat, but, you know, you're trying to win something. So get some feedback. Show it to your friends before you even submit it. Send it out to two or three people. Get some other eyes on it. That's what I say.
Aside from what you've already mentioned, what would you say are some of the more common criticisms that you've had for maps that you've seen that have had some common issues?
Layout tends to be a problem. A lot of people will have, you know, really crowded areas of the map or really blank areas of the map. And the cartographic salon is a little different from some of the other salons, which are purely artistic, because it has technical aspects as well as artistic aspects. Your line weights, for instance, your lettering, the type of font you choose for your map. It all needs to be clear to convey that information easily and be able to be reproduced. A lot of maps are published in a publication somewhere, a book or a magazine or a newsletter. And if it doesn't reduce well to fit on an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper, then that's going to be a problem as well. So, you know, avoid serif fonts like Times New Roman, terrible font for maps. Go with sans serif fonts. Keep things clean. Have an eye to that aesthetic appeal as well. Some of the best maps, even though they might be technically correct, just, you know, they don't jump out at you. You've got to have heavier line weights for the passage walls and lighter line weights for detail inside those walls and, you know, have a nice border on your map and all those kinds of things. And, you know, people sometimes they're doing maps that maybe they're not quite as happy with and it's got some extra blank space. So they tend to fill them up with, you know, a lot of photos just to put, here's pictures of the cave. We always call that gratuitous use of photos or just like gratuitous use of color. People will just slap a little color on a map for no apparent reason. And it doesn't really get you extra points in the competition. The judges are all, you know, savvy to that. And I'll just say, you know, what's this for? People say, well, you know, it makes it look nicer, but it doesn't always make it look nicer. Some of the best maps I've seen are just plain black and white.
Well, okay, and along those lines, and we're not really in the business of having people chase down maps if they're not privy to them, but in your time of looking at a lot of maps, what are some of the best ones you've ever seen?
Oh, the Bosted, Peter Bosted makes great maps. Peter Sprouse makes good maps. Pat Cambyses makes phenomenal maps. But there's a lot of up-and-comers out there that I can't even name all the names. Paul Berger has had some great maps. Joel Despain's had some great maps. There's dozens and dozens of really wonderful cartographers producing stuff in all regions of the country. And I'm enjoying seeing some of the new folks and kind of encouraging them along the way, too, because, you know, maps are important. Maps are one of the first ways to document a cave. If you go in a cave, you know, yeah, it's fun, but it's also science. You may be the first or possibly even the only people to ever visit that spot. And it kind of behooves us to document those, you know, make the map, note the kind of flora and fauna you may see in the cave, make notes of the geology. Even if you're not trained, you can just say, hey, yeah, there was a dark band of rock running down the middle of the cave, or I saw a cluster of bats, or there was a salamander, things like that. Even those things are important.
I've talked to some people who don't really like the idea of resurveying a cave that everybody knows just to make a new map. I don't know. Where are you on that?
Well, that depends a lot. Survey, like any trip, is impact in the cave. Anytime you go in the cave, you're doing something. And we always, you know, try to have that leave no trace ethic. But you're still in there and you're still doing some damage. You're trampling sediments on the floor. You're rearranging the rocks. You're providing extra heat into a cave, whatever. So you don't want to do this over and over and over. And sometimes it is a wasted effort if people have surveyed the cave. It's especially big multi-year projects. They've done this, but they won't release the data. Or the notes get lost, or they run a fire or something. And it's like, ah, man, now we got to do all that work over again. And it seems a little exhausting at times, but it's important. The map is the basis of all other science that happens in a cave. You can't document, you know, the cave microclimate and where these insects may be or where these bats may be roosting or where the archaeology is or whatever without a base map to put it on. You know, that's the root of all cave science.
You mentioned your Ruth Cave project, which was pretty impressive, where, you know, it went from 500 feet to over a mile. You also did kind of something similar in Rupert Cave. Tell me about that one.
Oh, yeah, Rupert. That was a good find and another one of my favorite caves. This was a little cave. I don't know. It had 1,500 feet or so of map. No, not even that. Like 700 feet, I think, of map passage at the time. Really nice map made by Bernie Smeltzer back in the 50s. Really detailed. Bernie was he was ahead of the time on his cave map techniques. This cave had been trashed. It had been stripped of formations. There was graffiti on all the walls. It was just a, you know, local sacrifice cave. The firefighters would use it for practice and so on because it was fairly easy. Kind of a maze cave, a whole lot of parallel passages with a couple of connectors, cross joints. And I was in there with a group of students. I used to do a lot of environmental education programming and just waiting for them to go check out this one pit that I'd climbed up and down several times and, you know, in the past and didn't want to bother with it again. Leaning against the wall, and I felt this breeze. And I go, well, that's weird. Where's this breeze coming from? And I moved around, poked my head around, and it was coming out of a pile of breakdown at my feet. I was like, well, that's weird, too. And so I pulled a couple of rocks out, and lo and behold, there's another little cross joint going in the passage, real low, right, you know, at the base of the floor, but it had been obscured by this breakdown. And so we spent several trips, I think three or four trips, working on that lead. There was some cemented breakdown on the floor in there, and it took some bigger and bigger tools every time to go in there and try to get that out. It finally popped through and got into a bunch more parallel passage, all virgin, really cool. The cave right now is almost 8,000 feet long, heavily decorated. Wow. There's, you know, like 6-foot broomsticks, stalagmites there, and beautiful rimstone, cave pearls and things. So it turned into a really nice cave. And fortunately, some friends of mine, some caver friends, actually bought it and own it, Karen and George Bang. They, you know, keep it open for cavers, and they protect the cave, and they're doing a really phenomenal job.
Since it was a sacrificial cave for so long, I mean, how was it kept protected after the fact? Was it gated or anything like that? I mean, you say that the landowners now are selective on who gets in. Cavers get in, but is there anything else in place?
Oh, actually, it is gated. In fact, there's a building over the entrance. This was built before the Bangs bought it. Previous owner had done this, having a little country retreat. It had a little fireplace built into the building, and they had a picnic table and a couple windows, and they would just, you know, use the cave as, I don't know, just a family fun thing. They'd go and just run up and down the passages. There was no harm in it. So the building itself now, you know, it's locked and secured, and yeah, it's a good gathering place. There's a bunch of cave decoration and paraphernalia around the building these days, so it's definitely a caver hangout.
I want to come back to your work in the bat world. You mentioned earlier you were a wildlife technician for the Pennsylvania Game Commission. What got you into that, other than just the love of caves? Was that something that you were into in college?
Well, yeah. I've got biology degrees, and I've always been interested in the natural world. One time I always thought I wanted to be a park ranger when I grew up. Like I said, I was a semi-employed cave bum back in the day, and I was caving 3 and 4 days a week sometimes, a lot of evening trips and weekend trips. So I've been in a lot of caves. We were trying to visit as many caves and get familiar with these things around central Pennsylvania as possible. And the Game Commission had just started that new non-game program. They had just issued their first ever conservation license plate. And so they were getting some extra money in for animals that you didn't hunt and shoot. So they had a lot of species in the state that hadn't had any survey or any information about since the 50s. They wanted to go back and check on some of these populations, particularly some of the more rare things. And bats was one of the target groups of animals. And so they directed all their technicians. They had 6 technicians, one in each region of the state. They directed them to contact the local grottos and find out if anybody knew anything about the bats. And they sent out postcards and these nice, really nice letters to all the grottos. And I sent in a stack of postcards. It was maybe a half inch thick from all the places I'd been. And they said, well, why don't you contact this guy, see if he'll take you and show you some of the caves. And so I did. I got their technicians trained up, because they had no clue what caving was about. So we got them, ordered them the right equipment, made sure they went to a NCRC OCR, the Orientation for Cave Rescue, the weekend training, and taught them all, you know, the good, safe cave habits and then leave no trace ethic and so on. And they taught me more and more about that. So it was a really good relationship. I volunteered with them for a couple of years, just during the winter months, doing winter bat censuses. And as they got more and more money through their program, they hired me on seasonally, and I started doing some summer bat work, mist netting, and looking at bat roosts in barns and churches and places like that, and eventually got hired on full time. I was with the Game Commission for 8 years before I moved to Texas.
Okay, so I'm gonna play devil's advocate here. This is not something that I believe, but I've thought about this. So the bat world has really changed in the last 15 years, obviously because of WNS. And it makes me think that the impact that bats have on the ecosystem has greatly decreased. And while it is still extremely important to know what bats are up to, And perhaps maybe now even more important, I just wonder, coming from someone with your background, how you feel about that thought, I suppose.
No, this is something we predicted a long time ago, actually. You know, bats do an incredible service with natural pest control. They're the main predator of nighttime flying insects, which include most of our moth species, many of our beetle species, various other things like leafhoppers and so on. And a lot of those nighttime flying insects are fairly destructive pest species at times. And so you remove the predators, you're going to increase the prey. I mean, it's just a, you know, it's a calculation that way. You know, we said, well, you know, we're probably going to have more outbreaks of some of these damaging forest pests, like, you know, emerald
ash borers
and you know, pine woolly edelgig beetles or whatever they are, you know, those kinds of things. I'm not an entomologist, sorry. And also probably on agricultural pests as well. And it's a little too early to see those big outbreaks yet, but it looks like some of that's starting to happen. We're losing more and more of our trees in the eastern forests. Farmers are having to spray more and more pesticide because of the loss of bats. It's maybe not widespread. It may be just localized effects because you used to have a big bat colony near you and now you don't. But I think things are probably going to get worse until the bats populations start to rebuild. There's some signs of that in various places, but whether we can call that a trend or not, it's too early to say.
I mean, I don't know how closely you look at the public perception of bats, because that's a constant frustration in my world, people just being afraid of bats and things like that. But I do feel like, to a degree, WNS has softened that unnecessarily negative public attention to bats. I don't know if you've seen the same.
Well, it certainly has brought more attention to bats. Bats have been in the press more because of their plight now than, you know, for scary reasons. That's a good thing. You know, there's definitely more bat press out there. There's also more people studying bats now because of this. There's been a lot of money thrown at WNS. Not that any of it's done much good. We haven't seen many bats saved because of that, but we know a lot more about their behavior. We know a lot more about the effects of the diseases on bats. We know a lot more about cave mine microclimates where the bats are roosting because of that. As there's, you know, just a host of researchers and graduate students out there studying these things. In some cases, you know, it's good to get that knowledge, but in some cases, all that research is also creating additional impact on roosting bats that don't need additional impact at that time. You know, they're already stressed. The WNS comes through, and then you have a bunch of researchers blundering around in the cave. Even if they're trying to be quiet and everything, you know, it's still causing stress to the bats, and it still makes them awaken in the winter months and use up some of that necessary fat. So it's a double-edged sword. You know, you can't manage what you don't know. And, you know, getting information is important.
Well, I mean, it seems like you've got some opinions on the management. And I only want you to go as far as you're comfortable. But it does seem like there are a lot of knee-jerk reactions on the part of people who are managing these things. And I can understand. But when you don't fully understand the situation, but you're put in charge of it, you feel like you've got to make drastic moves in order for anything to happen. What do you think should be done now that we know what we know and it's been around as long as it has and it's spreading the way that it is?
Well, you're right about the knee-jerk reactions. You know, you've got a lot of agency folks who are tasked with an incredible amount of responsibilities. They have to deal with everything from people to plants. And all of a sudden, they're thrown this curveball. You know, here's a bunch of important bats, and here's this disease and everything. They're totally unprepared for it. They don't have the training or background. They don't have the staff. They don't have any additional funding, usually, to deal with it. And so they do what is easiest for them, and that's close the caves. You know, boom, we're just closing them. But to be honest, after all these years of cave closures and so on, it's really made no effect on the bat populations. Cavers stay out of the caves. Cavers understand. Cavers, you know, they're organized. There's that informational pipeline out there that cavers tune into, so they know these things. It's the spelunkers. It's the unaffiliated folks, you know, the high school kids, the youth groups, the rock hounds, the other adventure seekers. You know, they're the ones that are still going into these places and causing the disturbance. So these cave closures are keeping out the people that could be assisting with the problem, being the volunteers and keeping an eye on the resources and helping out, helping these agencies, but they're not keeping out the people that are causing the most impact and destruction in these sites. So it's these cave closures are, they're not working. In fact, they're doing the opposite of what they should be doing. So, you know, I don't, maybe on a case-by-case basis, if a certain cave is particularly vulnerable and important, yeah, let's keep a closure, maybe a year-round closure, if not a seasonal closure. But just blanket closures on all caves in the National Forest or all caves here or all caves there is counterproductive.
It seems to me like outreach from grottos and the NSS would really help. But, you know, as you and a lot of people listening know, there's no shortage of secrecy in the caving world, and it's just not kind of our default response to get out there. But I really feel like it would help.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And there are a lot of instances where local cavers do have really good working relationships with their agency, with their local National Forest folks or, you know, Army Corps of Engineer folks, if there's, you know, caves on a base or something like that. And they're working closely with them. And, you know, those folks, those managers then tend to be a lot better educated and a lot more, I don't know, sensitive about those things. But there are still an awful lot of public lands that don't have that caver friend nearby or friends that are doing those kinds of things. Working with them, but sometimes just breaking in. You know, you don't just call up the district ranger on a forest and say, hey, I'm a caver and I'd like to help, because they're just going to blow you off.
Well, and it seems like through your consulting company and through all of the volunteer efforts that you've led in building bat gates and things like that, that you're kind of working on that issue, that problem.
I am, but you know, you'd be surprised. I still get a lot of pushback, even from cavers. You know, I don't particularly like gates myself. You know, to me, seeing a gate on a cave is kind of admitting that all other efforts to protect that cave have failed. A cave gate is a last-ditch protection effort. It's not your first line of defense, it's your last. You know, we do try to educate. You use the signage, you use some administrative closures, you know, you post the thing saying, hey, this cave's closed between this month and this month. And if that stuff doesn't work, sometimes you're forced to go with a gate. Cave gates are really good protection if they're done right. There's a lot of folks out there building cave gates. I mean, I did this when I was with the local grotto. We built a couple of gates on caves at the landowner's request. And I look back at those now and shudder. They were horrible gates for the cave. Gates should not just keep people out, but gates should also protect the cave ecology, which means they shouldn't alter the airflow and the temperature and the humidity and the whole cave ecosystem. Gates need to be biologically transparent, but they need to be secure. And those are kind of opposing concepts. But the bat-friendly gates we use, the angle iron gates we use now, and placed in the proper location in the cave, can do that. You never put a gate in a restriction, for instance, because bats are already slowing down to go through those restrictions. The restriction's already a bottleneck for airflow. And a gate in a restriction is just bad juju. You need to put a gate in a large diameter cross-section. But that costs more money, of course. It's more materials, takes more time. But that's better for the cave. And there's a lot of things like this. We've done a series of workshops across the United States. We call them our National Cave Gating Workshops. We haven't done one in a few years, but I'm hoping to get one up next year. The idea is to teach managers who may be, you know, writing proposals for cave gates, or cavers, or contractors that want to build cave gates, get them some of that information, not just, you know, here's the the mechanics of a gate, but here's the reasoning and the philosophy and the do's and don'ts about building a gate.
What are we still learning about an ideal gate that protects the cave from trespassers, but also completely, not completely, because obviously it's an impact no matter what you do, but best facilitates the current environment, which is what needs to be protected?
Well, again, it's about the materials and the design and the placement. Placement is really, really important. And I say design, too, because, you know, not every cave and not every entrance is the same. They're not all just, you know, a big walk-in tunnel.
Sure.
You have sloping entrances. You have sinkhole entrances. You have pit entrances. You have some that are in a jumble of breakdowns, some that are in nice solid rock, some that are surrounded by soil. And from a caver perspective, I look at these gates that I build. It's like, how could I break into this? How could I break into my own gate? What's the weak link here? Is somebody going to tunnel under it? Is somebody going to move some loose rock on the side of the gate and just bypass the gate entirely? Or is there another entrance that somebody's going to go and dig? It might be a sinkhole right next to the known entrance, but you know nobody's bothered with a sinkhole because they know it connects right away. Boom, it's going to go into the passage. Yeah, I can see the collapse. And yet if you put a gate on that entrance, somebody's going to go move the rocks out of that sinkhole and they're going to bypass the gate through make a second entrance. So you've got to look at all those kinds of things. And your basic, you know, Joe Welder from down the street, from Joe's welding shop that gets the low bid contract, he's going to put up the gate, do it the cheapest way he can, and walk away. And, you know, he's not a caver. He doesn't understand bats. It might not be a very bat-friendly gate to begin with, but he got the low bid because that was the purchasing requirements from the agency that was wanting the gate. I've been turned down for a lot of gates just because a lot of projects because my prices come in fairly high, but it's you get what you pay for on these things.
How hard is it to explain that to people, though?
some people are very receptive to this, and you know we look at creative funding methods for them. Other folks, you know, they're just you know they're in the bureaucracy. They do it that same way every time, and you know it has to go out for bid. Okay, so be it. I'm saying you know. In 5 years, somebody's going to have to come back and replace your gate, and then you've wasted even more money. Do it right the first time. There are some other good gate builders in this country. You know, Keith Dunlap's done some good stuff in Indiana. The IKC's built some really nice gates, and when I was with BCI, I you know helped encourage some of those things. And there's a few other folks, Jim Cooley in Missouri. He does a lot of good stuff with the CRF folks out there in Missouri. They built some really nice gates. But there's not too many. It's a very small group of people who understand the biology, the caver aspects, the engineering aspects, and the construction mechanics.
Can you tell me a little more about what's going on in San Marcos, the National Cave and Karst Management Symposium?
Oh, gladly. I'm a big cheerleader for that because I'm the chair of the event.
Yeah.
The NCKMS, National Cave and Karst Management Symposium, happens every other year. It's not an annual event. And it's a gathering of cave managers, cave owners, cave researchers, cave conservancies, all kinds of folks that are dealing with cave management. And if you think about it, just about everything you do caving-wise involves management in some aspect, even a cave rescue impacts the cave, and you have to think about you know how this cave is going to react to this rescue. If you have to go in and modify passages, or you have 50 people in the cave all of a sudden, you know that's management. We have show cave owners involved, everything. So this event, it's a week long conference. There are presentations, of course, as in most conferences. We have a day of field trips. We have a lot of parties in the evening socials and so on. We're going to Natural Bridge Caverns for one, getting a behind the scenes tour of a new development that they're opening up in another part of the cave. We're going to ride glass bottom boats on Spring Lake and see where the water comes out of the springs, the underwater springs that form the San Marcos River. So it's the head of the river. We're going to go to Bracken Bat Cave, owned by BCI. Most of the bats will be gone in November, but there'll still be some, and we're going to get a tour and a presentation on their management and what they've done in their conservation efforts. So there's going to be a lot of fun things happening, some great talks, and I encourage everybody to come. We've got there was a really nice article we had in the last NSS News. If you haven't seen that, go check that out. It gives you more information, and you can go to the website, which is symposium2021.nckms.org.
Okay, and I'll put that link in the description of the podcast as well. What would you say you're most excited about with regard to getting all these minds in the same area, talking about solutions and things like that? What do you think is going to come?
Well, it's a fun conference. I've been doing these things since 1997. And I was, when I worked for Back Conservation International, I was their representative on the steering committee. And when I left BCI, I still wanted to be involved. Mike Warner, who was the NSS representative, wanted to step down and move on to some other pursuits. And so I was able to step up into the NSS's representative role. And as the NSS representative, I'm actually the chairperson for the steering committee. The steering committee exists to make sure we have these symposia around the country every other year. That's about it. We hold a little money, but the steering committee doesn't do much else. And it's fun because you see a lot of the same folks, a lot of the folks that are like the cave specialists in the National Park Service or the Forest Service or the BLM. We get to see those. We get to talk about what the agencies are up to and what they're doing and what problems they're facing and what new and innovative solutions they're coming up with for various things. Cave management's been a passion of mine for years. I mean, you know, I love caves and I like to see them protected. No matter what, whether it's an archaeological site or it's got great speleothems or it's just a fun recreational cave, it doesn't matter. They're all important, and they all need help. Caves are abused all the time. And so this is a way to get that information out, share this, get it out there and into the world. I wish more people would look up the old proceedings. There's a lot of wonderful, wonderful information in those. A lot of times I see groups, you know, reinventing the wheel. They're saying, hey, we're going to do this and this and put up some kind of gate or do this. And it's like, well, you know, that's been done. And people have done it, maybe done it better, maybe done it worse. But there's lessons to be learned. And so people, you know, instead of just saying, well, I don't know what to do. We own a cave now. What do we do? There's a wealth of information out there, a whole body of literature and a lot of experts out there that can help. And all you have to do is reach out and find it.
You're going to chair the 2025 convention. I imagine you're a little busy with the National Cave and Karst Management Symposium right now to be able to talk about what you want to do in 4 years. But I don't know. What are you thinking? What would you like to see happen?
Yeah, I'm a glutton for punishment, right?
a little bit.
Things. We had some friends over the other day, and they were saying, my wife was saying, why do you keep doing this stuff? And one of my friends said, because nobody else does.
That's true.
That's one of the reasons maybe I do keep volunteering, because I like to see these things happen. I think they're important. And Carol Tiedemann keeps asking me, do you have any information about the convention? I said, no, wait till this symposium is over. I got too much going on now. But yeah, I'm hoping to do it in Texas again. We haven't been in Texas since 2009 when the International Congress for Speleology was here. And so that's quite a gap. The last other NSS convention was in 94, I'm sorry, and everybody really enjoyed that. So I'm hoping to do another one. Now, we have some problems in Texas with facilities and so on. Texas is a huge state, you know, and there's a lot of cavers in Austin, there's a lot of cavers in San Antonio, and there's a lot of caves, but they tend to be relatively smallish. They're, you know, a lot of urban areas with karst. Things tend to be more expensive around those big cities as well. So I'm looking to move back out to West Texas again, like we had in 94. And I'm thinking Del Rio, Texas. Del Rio is right on the border. You can drive across the bridge and you're in Mexico and see Ciudad Acuña. And so I'm thinking like having a Tex-Mex convention. And it'll be an international National Speleological Society convention where we have a lot of our field trips and so on in northern Mexico, because there's some awesome caves and wonderful stuff and people and everything and experiences. And so folks that haven't traveled outside of the U.S. and haven't caved somewhere else, this will be a real nice, easy introduction to Mexican caving for them. And, of course, we have a lot of really good stuff out in West Texas, some really big, nice caves. So we can have some really good field trips. We can have a good geology tour. A lot of nice things. Del Rio is a much less expensive city. It's got a really nice big civic center. It's got a school. It's near Lake Amistad National Recreation Area, which is a National Park Service unit that has several hundred miles of lake shore on Lake Amistad. It's all limestone, and there's several hundred caves on the park as well, even though they may only be open by permit. We'll have to see what we can do about getting access to some of those caves. But I think it'd be fun. We've got everything we need for a convention. We just need to get people. Hopefully some of my current committee for the symposium will transfer to the convention committee as well, because I have a really great staff right now. We just have to figure out all the details and make it happen. But I think 4 years will be plenty of time to do that.
Well, let's do a little caving. What are some current projects you got going on?
Well, I have a project in northern Mexico, actually, that I've been working on. In fact, I'll be going there over Thanksgiving for 2 weeks, called Proyecto Laguna de Sanchez, named after the little town of Laguna de Sanchez. It started out, I went down there to do some bat work with a friend. There was three known caves in the area that were mapped by some Germans back in 1985. And we are now currently up to 240 known caves. 85% or so have been surveyed. We still have another 30 or 40 good caves that need surveyed. And then there's a whole lot of little, what we call FROs, for the record only, just little things. But, you know, we're still documenting them all, because the place is just riddled with sinks and cave entrances. And we don't want to, you know, have somebody keep stumbling over the same sinkhole year after year after year and saying, I found something new. And next thing, we knew that one. So, yeah, we're putting all that stuff in our database. And caves tend to be fairly small. I mean, you know, I think the longest cave is probably under 500 feet. Some of them are deeper than others. The deepest ones, we do everything metrically there and in Texas. So deepest cave is 70 or 80 meters, so 250 feet, something like that. Not terribly deep, but a lot of them are vertical, short little drops. We're biologizing and everything. Of course, we're GPSing and photographing and mapping as we go. And it's just been great fun. The people are friendly. The scenery is spectacular. We eat well. So it's a great fun trip, and everybody's invited. I mean, if somebody wants to go to Mexico and do a little easy caving, we call our trips Expedition Light. It's not like, going to Cheve and having to camp underground for 2 weeks and eat freeze-dried food every day. This is, this is kind of plush camping and caving in Mexico.
You can be able to say you did it without kicking your ass.
Yeah, absolutely. You don't have to be in, freaking awesome shape. Even though we are, usually around a mile in elevation there. So, the altitude will get you a little bit on some of the hikes, but it's not too awful. I'm also working on another cave in West Texas called Pumpkin Cave.
Oh, I've heard about this one, yeah.
It's owned by the Texas Cave Management Association, and it's an incredible maze. It's a three-dimensional maze. It's a hypogene cave, so it's got all this boneyard like you hear about in parts of Lechuguilla and so on. And part of that boneyard has collapsed and formed this big, massive sinkhole entrance, a big, pit entrance. But once you get down into the pit, you can drop your vertical gear. You don't need it anywhere else in the cave. We've got about 3 miles mapped in there so far. And there's still, by my estimates, a kilometer and a half of leads that we still need to mop up. Most of them are just going to be loops and infill in already known passages. Not a lot of it's out on the fringe of the cave. But the cave blows air in many, many places. We haven't done any serious pushing on those blowholes yet, because we keep hoping we'll bypass them. We'll keep hoping somewhere in this maze we'll find another passage that goes around that restriction and pop into some more cave. And that's happened one or two times already. Rather than mining our way in through a blowing lead, we're going to just keep mopping up survey. But I haven't been there in about 2 years because of the stupid pandemic. It's really put a damper on my caving like everybody else in the country.
Yeah, but have you been able to do anything fairly recently? I imagine you've been caving a little bit.
Yeah, actually, about 2 weekends ago, I went out to Lake Amistad on a Peter Sprouse project where we have, in conjunction with the Park Service there, we're out mapping caves that are on the park. They found a lot of new ones looking at some LIDAR data. The park is vast, and a lot of it's just scrubland, and it's a very arid, deserty kind of environment. You know, but it's all limestone. It's wonderful limestone. So they looked at a lot of LIDAR work, a lot of LIDAR imaging, and found a lot of potential entrances, went out and checked and said, oh, yeah, this is a cave. This is another cave, and there's another cave. And while they were looking for some of those caves, they stumbled upon some new ones because some of them have entrances so small they don't even show up on the LIDAR. So we were mapping those. We had two teams. Peter Sprouse organized that trip. Two teams surveying caves, and I think we did, let's see, my team did 7 caves in 2 days, and the other team did 5. So we did, you know, like a dozen caves in 2 days. That was fun. I hadn't caved like that in a long time, and, you know, we're out collecting bugs for the park and, you know, mapping the cave. I had a wonderful time.
That is marvelous. And you and I kind of have something in common in that we have children with cave-related names. My son's name is Sullivan, and he's not officially named after Sullivan Cave in Indiana, but it was a joke when I brought it up to my wife when we were thinking about names, and I said, what about Sullivan? Because I love Sullivan Cave. It was my first cave. It's one of my favorites. And she was like, well, now wait a minute. I really love that. And now Sully is our 2-year-old son. And so what's your 5-year-old's name?
My 5-year-old's name is Kraz, K-R-A-S.
Kraz, Crash, all right.
Yeah, well, Kraz is the region of Slovenia where karst as a geological phenomenon was first described. So it's the type locality for karst.
Okay.
And then the word has been Germanified over the years into karst, which is what, you know, we use in English-speaking countries now. But so he's named Kraz, Karst. He loves it. I wanted something, you know, when we had kids, my wife and I both talked about, we wanted some kind of nature name. And, you know, a lot of the botanical names, fern, daisy, rose, tend to be feminine. And so I couldn't think of much. I didn't, you know, weren't crazy about Sierra and things like that. And, you know, if we had a girl, we eventually settled on Aurora. We were going to call her Aurora. I said, ah, that's a really lovely name. But he came, you know, we didn't know the sex of the boy until he was born. We wanted to be surprised. So he came out a boy. And it's like, oh, we really didn't settle on a male name yet. But we had kicked around a lot of names. We had this whiteboard and we were writing all these potential names on. And I was trying to find something, again, natural, and I, you know, doing geological stuff. And I went through this geologic glossary one time, and all of a sudden it struck me. It's like Kraz. I was like, oh, yeah, it's a great name. Short, kind of powerful, and, you know, nature-related and everything. And so he got Kraz from my side, and Yaz gave him Leonardo as his middle name because she really liked that. And I said, oh, God, people are going to say you named him after a mutant ninja turtle. So, no, Da Vinci. It's like, that's not what people are going to think. But anyhow.
But he's a caver.
So, yeah, he's a caver. He loves it. He's been in probably about 20 caves already, some of them more than one time. And he's got his own little Petzl helmet. He's got a harness, although Yaz has yet to let me put him in a vertical cave, but I'm going to soon. Mm-hmm. He's got boots and gloves and his headlamps and everything, and he just goes for it. He knows bugs. He can go in there and tell you all the things that live in the cave and the speleothems and how they're formed and why you should protect them and why they're important. He'll just go up to people, random people, and he'll start talking about caves.
Well, okay, so I need some advice from you then. So I've got a soon-to-be 2-year-old. By the time people hear this, he'll pretty much be 2. His birthday is August 3rd. And then I've got a 4-year-old, and I want to at least introduce them to caving the right way. Whether or not they want to be cavers is up to them. But you, it seems, have fostered a curiosity, and of course you have the knowledge to back it up. I don't know, how do you think you got him so curious about it? And I don't know, how have you facilitated that?
We used to call him Adventure Baby when he was little, and
so it just came naturally for him to a degree.
Yeah, Venture Boy. I mean, when he was 6 months old, we took a 3-week road trip to go out to the Ely, Nevada convention. And we spent a week just visiting national parks and national forests on the way up there, spent the week there, and then a week back doing the same thing, more national parks and forests. So, you know, caving and camping and hiking and stuff, he's just been introduced to it since he was a baby. Every year we go out on various trips. We, you know, we'll go to the mountains, we'll go to the beach, we go caving. We, you know, I'll take him on projects with me. He went to the last National Cave and Karst Management Symposium in Virginia with me, you know, he and I, because mom had to work that week. So, you know, he's, travel is second nature to him. He knows it. He's not intimidated by it. He's not intimidated by camping. He loves to do stuff. He goes outside and, you know, he's always finding toads and snakes and whatever in the backyard. And, you know, remember, the kid's five.
Yeah.
But, you know, we watch all kinds of videos. We read books. He's well-based in science and well-based in the environment around him.
And I guess along those lines, how much is there to be said about mentoring adults to become cavers? Because I talked to Rachel Saker at Speleofest. Yeah. And she's kind of a protege of yours. And I'm sure that she's not the only one. I'm sure you've mentored a lot of people in the caving world. But there's a hesitancy to do that among some cavers, to take somebody under their wing unless they're at a certain level. I don't know. I feel like if someone showed an interest to me just because I'm crazy about caving and caves, I'd want to share that. I don't know. How could you encourage that in the caving community?
Well, Matt, I'd love to take you to Mexico with me sometime.
I'd love to go.
But, yeah, it is tough because you get a lot of people that are, you know, one-shotters. You know, they just want to do it to tick off something on their list. Yeah. I bungee jumped. I've hang glided. I've caved. I've snorkeled. I've whatever. You know, they just want another experience to add to their life list. It's okay to do that in a way, but, you know, you feel like you're kind of wasting that time. You have very limited time. You want to go caving as much as possible, but you want to make sure that you're investing that energy with somebody that's going to see it through. And sometimes you can see that spark in people. You can see that enthusiasm where they're like, oh man, yeah. Can I, you know, I'm going to ask you some more questions. Can I borrow this book? Or, hey, I've got a trip coming up, but, you know, I need to, you know, get my vertical skills honed a little more. You know, can you take some time to help me? And the people that really ask and that really, you know, want to do those things, you can kind of tell. And it's really good when you get that, when you see that. And it's like, yeah, I'll, you know, you want to borrow gear? You want to sign up for this trip? You know, now I think that trip may be a little more difficult than you want. Let's try this one first. And so you can give them good advice and steer them in certain ways. And, you know, they turn out to do some amazing things usually. I've seen a lot of people over the years. I mean, I've been doing this for decades now, most of my life. And it's great. You know, I'm going to be caving probably until I die. It's something that I enjoy a lot. It's very important to me. It's exercise, it's adventure, and it's science. You know, I've always wanted to make sure we do the science while we're doing this. If there's too many caves, too little time, I want to, you know, get in there and map them all and explore them all, dig in them all. There's a lot of caves, too, that, you know, people have been going to and going to and going to, and they say, yeah, it's the same old cave, but, you know, it's not been pushed out. There's digs to be made. There's crawls to crawl through and squeezes to make and climbs to do. There's a lot of real exciting exploration going on these days with old caves that people hadn't been to for 100 years. And, you know, now there's all these big breakouts and fascinating things happening. You know, it's great to get new people and get people out there to do that. But even if you're just taking a Boy Scout troop to, you know, your local cave that they've been going to over and over, some of them might end up like me. Some of them might end up like you. They might just, you know, all of a sudden somebody gets the bug and they, you know, they want to do it forever.
I always like to talk to people who do survey and who have been, you know, doing it for quite some time. I try to come up with different things to ask them each time. I guess what's coming to mind for me right now is, you know, survey can take you into some pretty grim places. What's been among some of the more grim situations you found yourself in doing cave survey?
That's a good question. You know, I've surveyed through guano.
Ugh.
I've surveyed through low air space in gross wet passages. I've surveyed down pits. It's all part of it. Nothing really stands out, I guess. But one thing that I really enjoy about the survey is it's very intimate. I mean, you really learn the cave. You're not just busting through the cave. You're going at a fairly slow pace. You're looking around, and you're seeing all these relationships in the cave that you may not have noticed otherwise. You see, okay, well, there is a little lead on the floor over here. You know, I didn't notice that before because it just looked like a hole, you know, in between two rocks. But it actually might go. Or you also notice, like, hey, you know, I just mapped around here, and look, we almost came back to where we started. I didn't realize that when I went through the cave the first time. I thought we were kind of going in a straight line. You know, maybe if we, you know, push through this crawlway, it might make a connection. We make a loop. Awesome. That's great. Or we might connect to another cave that's coming up close. You also get to see the fossils in the walls. You get to see the little tiny speleothems, the little crystal clusters and things like that. You get to see the bugs. You get to see the life of the cave that you don't see when you're just, you know, hey, we're in a hurry. We're going, you know, back to the back of the cave and see how fast we can do it. You know, that's, okay, speed records. But, you know, you don't learn the cave that way. So you really get the personal, up close and personal feel of the cave when you're surveying.
I guess what I think about sometimes when I'm going through a cave and I'm going through a particularly difficult part of the cave is when the people who surveyed this came through here, or maybe the people who first came upon it, whether they were surveying it or not, and kept going, you know, what was in their head to keep going? Because there are some parts of caves that I've been through where it's like, if I were the first person going here, not knowing what's beyond this, I don't think I would have kept going.
Again, you can't manage what you don't know. And if you only know part of the cave, well, you know, you may mismanage it.
But being involved with NCRC yourself, I mean, you've got to find, I imagine that you've got to find that balance between pushing, you know, and feeding the explorer part of yourself, but also being careful about it. Because, like, if you're finding yourself in a place where you can keep going, but if it stops, you really can't turn around or you can't back out, depending on where you are or what's going on. I don't know. How do you balance that?
Well, you hope you're caving with a really good team.
Yeah, I guess so.
People that can help you if you get in trouble. But yeah, you have to use some modicum of common sense. I've been in some situations that have been a little dicey in the past, but not always. I mean, well, I'll give you an example of something we just pushed a couple weeks ago. We were at Amistad. We were mapping this cave and went down this little climb down pit, mapped some passage, and everything's all, you know, not very big, kind of a small cave. But there was one crawlway that I could look back and I could see it went a long ways and it looked like it opened up. And it was just dirt floor. And I kept saying, oh man, I really want to dig in this. Oh yeah, but you know, I had the rest of the team to think about, you know, everybody may want to go and so on. So we talked about it. And I said, sure, give it a shot. We had no tools. I just picked up some sharp rocks and started digging away at the sediments. And it took, well, probably a half an hour or so. And we eventually dug through it, and we more than doubled the length of the cave. We got into some of the nicest parts of the cave, really pretty and everything. But I'm not in my 20s anymore. I'm not as skinny as I used to be. I'm not as flexible as I used to be. I have a lot more injuries than I did back then. And so I was a little uncomfortable going through that thing. You know, I would dig it, and it's like, man, I think I could squeeze through it, but I don't want to. And so I backed out, and we would dig some more. And I did that two or three times, and I backed out, and I just digged more, and I just, you know, took a little extra time and modified it and made it, and now it's a nice, easy, comfortable crawl. Anybody can go through it, but, you know, I just said, I'm not going to get myself stuck or not get in a position where I'm starting to feel a little claustrophobic because, you know, those body size squeezes just kind of, I'm starting to get freaked out by them as I get older and older. When I was younger, yeah, I'd go through that stuff and cracked a few ribs and so on, but nowadays, like, nah, not worth it.
No thanks.
I just want to encourage folks, you know, look, guys, you know, caves are wonderful places. They're also fragile places. They can be dangerous places. Just read your ACA and you can see all the things that happen to people in caves when they're poorly prepared, and even some people that are prepared. I mean, look at me. You know, here I was, a very well-prepared caver, all the right equipment, doing the right things, not making any mistakes, and a rock moved. And it's like, okay, I kick a rock, no big deal. You know, you kind of like get your stance and, you know, low center of gravity. It's automatic after you've been caving a while. And then another rock moved, and all of a sudden this whole big breakdown slope just goes and takes me with it. I'm tumbling down, break both sides of my pelvis. Guano happens. Even if you're the best prepared, best equipped person, best experienced person in the world, things can happen to you. And you talk, a lot of the big name cavers, they all have their own stories to tell about something that happened to them that shouldn't have, a foothold breaks or something like that. And you have to be prepared for that. But, don't let that stop you. Bodies bounce back. Caves are always there, though. And if you can't get into a cave this year because of a landowner situation or some agencies close them, cave's still going to be there. In fact, it might be better off when people aren't going there. You never know. You know, give it a rest. So let's get out. Let's explore and document everything. Even if you write a trip report in your local newsletter and it says, I saw bats. Okay, maybe nobody ever recorded bats in that cave before, and somebody's going to go through a database someday, and they're going to be looking for bat caves to study for some new disease, and they're going to say, oh, here's a cave that had bats. Let's go check that cave out. And you've already saved them a lot of field work and a lot of time. Or if you saw salamanders or whatever it is you see, make notes of those things. You don't have to know the Latin names. Just be observant and record it. That's what science is, observation and recording.
Well, Crash, I really appreciate your time. This has been great. Let's see, you're chairing the convention in 2025. Hope Del Rio works out. Hope San Marcos goes well at National Cave and Karst Management Symposium. And good luck with, the list goes on and on. Good luck with everything.
Well, come to Laguna with me someday, Matt.
Oh, gosh. All right. As soon as I can find the time, I'm in, man.
Got your passport?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's current.
Good. Okay, good.
Thanks a heap.
You're welcome, man. Thanks.
Oh, man, what a caving life. And what a pleasure it was and an honor to talk to Crash Kennedy this month. I cannot wait to meet you in person, Crash. That was such a delight. And thank you for listening. This podcast is a labor of love for me. I love that this is what I do as part of the caving community. So many people have reached out and thanked me for doing this. And it is my pleasure. If you ever have any suggestions on who you'd like to hear, you can email me, alpineproductions@gmail.com. And again, our sponsor is El Spelio, and I want my El Spelio lunatic to see a little more action than I can show it. Email me if you are interested in doing that. I'll give this one more month. I think I know who I'd like to give it to, but I want to give you a chance to plead your case. I'll send you my El Spelio lunatic if you're going to show it some love. alpineproductions@gmail.com and inspire the confidence that I will see it again because I want it back. Thanks to our sponsors, past and present. Of course, El Spelio. Also, Swago. Go to swagogear.com. Organic Robot Designs. Organic Robot on Etsy or the brick and mortar store in Greenfield, Indiana. If you're a grotto that likes to make t-shirts, Charlie will hook you up. And, of course, support your grotto, support your local cave and karst conservancy, support the NSS. All right, is that everything? Who's coming on next month? Well, I don't know for sure. I don't know for sure. Maybe I'll do that Cave Caper Supercut. Maybe it'll be somebody. I know I've got another interview coming up, but I haven't done it yet, so I won't tell you who it is in case, it gets delayed for whatever reason. But things are happening. Things are happening, and I'm glad you're here for it. Until next time, I'm Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto, and kill nothing but time.